You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 5th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, is this the moment Donald Trump seals his place as the Republican Party's nominee? We'll look ahead to Super Tuesday as the US Supreme Court keeps Mr. Trump on the ballot in Colorado. Also ahead, the South Korean government vows to clamp down on striking junior doctors. We'll examine whether the threat of having their careers ruined will make them reconsider. Plus,
typically when you have a major accident, there's, you know, something, right? You know, there's a distress call. There's something that happens, or else there's a big amount of wreckage, or somebody's seen something. This MH370 is really unique, frankly.
A decade since its disappearance, we piece through the last traceable moments of flight MH370. Plus, China's premier refuses to speak to the global press. We round up Paris Fashion Week, where nobody seems to have been wearing a bra, and we go through the papers too. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in today's news. Israel's foreign minister has recalled the country's UN ambassador over claims that the United Nations try to keep quiet a report on sexual violence perpetrated by Hamas. A US Air National Guard has pleaded guilty to posting dozens of classified documents online. Jack Teixeira could face up to 17 years in jail. And hardliners have won a majority of the seats in Iran's parliamentary elections, which saw a record low turnout of 41%. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, how super is this year's Super Tuesday? With both President Joe Biden and Donald Trump all but guaranteed to take the Democrat and Republican presidential nominations respectively, there's more than a slight lack of excitement. One development that did happen yesterday, however, was that the US Supreme Court ruled that Mr. Trump's name may go on the ballot in Colorado. The state had banned him from standing over his involvement in the January 2021 Capitol riots. Well, I'm joined now by Monocle's US editor, Chris Lord. A very good evening to you, I should say, Chris.
Hi, good morning, Emma.
So 15 states vote today, but two of those states had previously barred Mr. Trump from the ballot. So this huge decision yesterday was one from the Supreme Court, wasn't it?
It was a huge decision as much as Super Tuesday goes ahead as planned, in as much as Donald Trump, anybody who puts his name down on that ballot in Colorado, he will be counted just as any other candidate. He will be there and those votes will be counted. I think it sets a precedent for any other state that has tried to do this, that has tried to remove him from their ballot. I think of places like Maine, for example, in the Northeast United States. They've all tried to have a go at kind of creating their own setup whereby he will be either disqualified from the ballot or his name will be removed. This kind of sets the thing now that that's not really going to happen in any of these primaries. That doesn't mean, however, that the Supreme Court has voted on whether or not Donald Trump is an insurrectionist, in as much as what happened in 2021, the assault on the Capitol, whether he actually stoked that up and made that happen and sort of whipped his followers into a frenzy that led them to assault the seat of power in Washington, D.C. They haven't ruled on that yet, and that's still yet to come. Unfortunately, that was supposed to be kick-off on Monday, that court case, which would be a federal court case, has been kicked down the can a little bit further, and it's probably not going to happen before this forthcoming election. But yes, to your point, I think it was a big ruling that from the Supreme Court, and a reminder where the seat of power is in the land. It doesn't sit with the states on some of this stuff. It sits there in Washington, D.C. and in the Capitol.
Or does it really? Because not to sort of go too granular on the reasoning of the judges, because they all gave different reasons, but the decision was unanimous. But one of the arguments that convinced them to keep Mr. Trump's name on the ballot was that this was not something that the Supreme Court could enforce. Only Congress could decide whether Donald Trump was an insurrectionist.
So right, so it comes back to that federal point. It comes back to a kind of a sort of decision amongst the various constituencies of the country about whether or not they're, rather than individual states making their rulings with different makeups and different courts and so on. I think we also have to understand that, you know, while it was unanimous, there were some of those liberal judges within the Supreme Court who had some reservations, if you like. Yes, they came to the same view, but they had reservations about how that ultimately happened. This court is still not immune from the partisanship that sort of, if you like, that is still very much part of the American discourse at the moment in politics. But I think also there is a sort of point to be made here, which is that while this might seem like, okay, you know, this ultimate federal case about what exactly went on in 2021 and Donald Trump's role, and it seems to have kicked the can down a little bit further, we have to also remember that there have been several states now that in their own Supreme Courts, within their states, have come to the conclusion that Donald Trump did act as an insurrectionist. And so therefore, if they've come to those rulings, then it sort of begs the question that as we get further down the line, what actually might that look like as it goes to a federal level? But to your point, Emma, I think that, you know, that what this Supreme Court judge ruling has said is that it is a federal point. It comes back to the seat of power and not to those individual states to determine where this goes.
He still faces what? A criminal trial in New York and another trial later on about the discovery of documents at Mar-a-Lago in Florida, doesn't he? I mean, he's still absolutely up to his knees in it, isn't he?
He's got 91 counts against him. And in fact, those two federal cases are still quite a way away. But the actual cases in sort of more localized courtrooms are about to kick off imminently. I mean, just this week, we're going to see the indictment, which is essentially about him being involved in paying hush money via a campaign manager to a former porn star to keep them quiet during the previous election campaign. I mean, there's a whole raft of these smaller cases that are not federal that he's going to have to wade through before we get to the election. But the actual big federal cases, which are the ones really that, you know, so many of those, frankly, legal opponents of Donald Trump who really worry about what it means for his name to be on that ballot again this year, those big cases, unfortunately, are probably not going to happen now, even though they've been mooted maybe for July, but they're probably not really going to happen now before the election kicks off. But still, there are many, many, many legal challenges for him in the next few months, ebbing away at that money that is at his own use, at his disposal, to keep campaigning as we get towards the election. But ultimately, yes, his name is not going to be out of the headlines, and not for very good stuff.
Notwithstanding, he is likely to cement his position as the Republican presidential nominee today, isn't he?
So let's think about what Super Tuesday is. In a way, it is a bit of a coronation, isn't it, for Donald Trump, and as much as where he's got so far, barring some extraordinary upset, this is going to be where it lands, is that most of the states, as we've seen, apart from only the tiny District of Columbia in Washington, D.C., being the only one that has voted that has given Nikki Haley any kind of success here through these primaries for the Republican Party. This is going to be probably in the same mold. We're going to see these 15 states from Colorado to Texas to California probably return a vote that says that the Republican voters there want to see Donald Trump leading the party into the next election. But I think there is some interesting things to take from where we are right now. The first is that if Nikki Haley continues to register those 30%, you know, 30-ish, nudging towards, knocking at the door of 40% votes, like she has done in many of these races that have led up to Super Tuesday, then really the campaign managers in the Trump campaign should be pretty worried, because that is a lot of Republican voters up and down the land who do not feel that they can get behind Donald Trump when it gets to a general election, particularly because Nikki Haley has now made really her campaign a sort of to keep Donald Trump out of the White House for the betterment of the United States. The question, I guess, what starts to become clear is, you know, when it actually gets to the general election day, are those people going to come home? Are they going to say, well, okay, yes, I voted for Nikki Haley previously because I really couldn't stomach another 4 years of Donald Trump? Or are they going to be the ones who say, well, do you know, now that guy's name is on the ballot, okay, I'm a Republican at heart and I'll always vote for him? Or are they going to be the ones who say, well, maybe I'm not going to vote for him, maybe I'm not even going to vote for Donald Trump, there will be third-party candidates on there and they're going to make a protest vote? We're in an election where the protest vote is becoming very potent, I would say. Maybe not powerful. It's not changing things, but it's being potent. It's making itself felt. The same is true for Joe Biden, let's not forget. You know, he just look at what's happened in Michigan in the last few weeks. We've had lots of Democrat voters, essentially, if you will, not commit themselves to any candidate because what they believe is that Joe Biden's backing for Israel in the war in Gaza makes him not a Democratic candidate they can vote for. Again, these are protest votes that are happening, but they're very important because once we get into general election moments, these are the forces that will ebb away support from those main candidates. And really then you've got a big fight, which is to bring those very skeptical people on side. And that's, I think, going to be the story of Super Tuesday once it kicks off. It's going to be that what the potency of the sort of protest vote, how big that's going to be. And I think ultimately as well, we have to say whether Nikki Haley's going to stick around. I mean, is she going to go through another drubbing at the elections and through these primaries on Super Tuesday, but still say, well, do you know what? I'm going to hang around because we just don't know where this is going to end up. You know, Emma, we were just talking a moment ago about legal challenges, about money ebbing out of the Trump campaign. She's sticking around because she believes that there just might be a chance that his name possibly doesn't end up on that ballot, and she'll be there to step into that place. And I think that is, while this is not a Super Tuesday where there is a sort of nail-biting, you know, fight for delegates amongst, you know, two main challenges on either party, it's still a very important one because, I guess, you know, not to sound too Pollyannish about things, but because democracy is being felt, because people are going out and exercising their vote, even if it's not the ones that the main challenges for these two parties want to hit.
Let's touch briefly, finally, on Biden. And you said that if people cannot get behind Joe Biden because of his stance on Israel, I mean, nonetheless, he's cruising to the Democratic nomination today, isn't he?
He is. I mean, there's no doubt about it. He's really unchallenged in the primaries. I mean, there are other people on that ballot, but we only have to look at the run up to this. But that doesn't mean that there isn't those voices, you know, within the party who express so much concern about the fact that they're going into an election with a candidate who so many people simply do not believe in. There's a candidate who simply hasn't been able to get his message across about why these last 4 years with him in power have been good. And you read and you talk to Americans and you try and understand a little bit the kind of position of those who I've met many of them who say, you know, I really like Joe Biden. I don't understand why people don't. Or conversely, people who say, I just don't believe in this guy. I don't think he talks straight. I don't think he's got our back. And look at how much more things are costing me. You know, the fight of this election right now, and it's going to change, you know, the other bits and bobs that come in and kind of shape what the narratives are going to be. But immigration and the border is a big thing. And so many people that I speak to simply feel that the last 4 years for immigration has been a disaster here in America. And how can they get that message across? You know, only now is Joe Biden going out and doing the networks. Only now is he appearing just this week in the New Yorker doing a sit-down interview. Only now is he going out and doing all that hard work of getting the press right, of getting the TVs, getting the channels right, getting them on side. And in some cases, yeah, you know, he's going to certain platforms that are probably preaching to the converted. But if you put it in line with what we just talked about, Emma, which is that you have within both parties people who simply say, the way this is ending up is not something I can get behind. I don't believe in either of these people. Well, that's when you have to get out and do the charm offensive. Is it too late for Joe Biden? Well, let's see. He's still going to end up on the ballot paper. But is that enough when it gets to that general election to, you know, as I say, not to be too gloom and doom. But frankly, you know, if we get to that moment of that general election to encourage people to get out of their door and go and vote, is he going to be the person who can do that? And frankly, lots of strategists in the Democrats who've been around that party for some years say it just might be a little bit too late and maybe he's not the man for the job, but the voters will decide.
Chris Lord in Los Angeles, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. This is The Globalist. Six 16:14 in Seoul, 7:14 a.m. here in London. Now, South Korea has warned that it is to take action against trainee doctors who are on strike over changes to the number of admissions to the medical profession. Operations and treatments have either been delayed or cancelled because of this action. Well, I'm joined on the line by John Lee, editor of Korea Pro. Good morning to you, John.
Good afternoon from Korea. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us. Just could you briefly recap why they are on strike, please?
Sure. About a month ago, the South Korean government announced that it was going to start to expand the medical school quota starting next year. Right now in South Korea, there are about 3,057, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that are currently allowed for the students to enroll each year. But the government says that starting in 2035, there will be a huge medical staff shortage. And so in order to mitigate that shortage, the government wants to expand that number by 2,000. Now, the doctors in Korea, especially those who are represented by their union, the Korean Medical Association, has been adamantly set against this expansion. And so ever since the government made that announcement, which the government has said is irreversible, thousands of trainee doctors, residents, have been protesting by submitting their leave of absence or by walking off their jobs, essentially.
And the effect on the ability for people to be seen and to be treated has been really quite profound, hasn't it?
Well, I don't want to give some sort of a horrific image of the South Korea's medical system. It's not crippled by any stretch of the imagination. Now, of course, there have been delays and there have been people whose surgery schedules have had to be postponed. And yes, there have been some people who died. I believe less than 10 have been reported so far. But right now, the government has also legalized telemedicine, and they've also opened up military hospitals for civilians to seek a treatment. And although the trainee doctors and the residents have been largely protesting, the actual doctors, the senior doctors, have not walked off yet.
Just explain to us a little bit, though, I mean, just how the government is reacting to this. They have said that they are now going to start to check on hospitals. How are they going to go about this?
Initially, about 9,000 trainee doctors walked off the jobs. And according to the latest numbers from the government, about 7,000 of them have not returned by the deadline. And so what the health ministry plans to do is to conduct on-site inspections. They're going to send out government inspectors to these hospitals across the country, and they are going to check for personnel. You see, although many of these residents submitted their leaves of absence, none of them have been accepted. And so if they are no longer attending their medical schools or working their rounds, they are doing this illegally. And so the government is saying that what they're going to do is they're going to start suspending the licenses of the doctors for at least 3 months initially. And of course, this will have a cascading effect, but that's the government's plan so far.
It's very much on the aggressive stance, isn't it? Because this could, and the warning has been given, ruin the careers of those doctors who are on strike, and they are just trainees now. So this could be life changing for many of them.
This could have long-term consequences, yes. But we have to remember that these doctors also picked a rather poor time to stage their protest. South Korea's general elections, the parliamentary elections, will take place in about a month. And the government will not do anything to appear weak before such crucial elections are about to take place. And so the government is very much set with its policies. They are not going to back down. And right now, neither are the doctors. So this is at an impasse at the moment. And what the long-term repercussions will be are not yet entirely clear. We just know that although the protesting doctors will have their licenses suspended for about 3 months, this could take longer if they ever decide to go back to medical school.
How much is the South Korean government in trouble over this? Because how it handles the protest and the strike could massively affect its popularity.
That would be the conventional wisdom. But if we look at the latest polls, a large number of the South Korean public is actually in support of the government's measures. About 76% of the country supports the government's decision to expand the number of medical school quotas. Now, of course, this could change if this prolongs. But right now, at least in the short term, and that's what the government is focused on right now, the next month's election, right now, the numbers look good.
And how, therefore, do you see future industrial action, not necessarily just in the medical profession, but across South Korea being affected by this? Because there is arguably the case that this could have a chilling effect on any other workers, you know, working groups deciding to take industrial action?
Well, sure. But we have also to remember that this is not the first time that this current administration has taken on such a hardline stance against unions. Since the President Yoon Suk-yeol has come into power in 2022, there have been numerous union-led protests against his administration's policies, and he has come down hard on many of them. This is just the latest one. And so will it have a chilling effect? Well, it has not stopped unions from trying in the past, and I'm sure that it will not stop them going forward.
John Lee, thank you so much for joining us on the line. Still to come on today's programme. Paris Fashion Week comes to a close, so we'll look back at highlights from the autumn winter shows right across the world of fashion. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is Paul Rhodes, Deputy Publishing Editor of Newsweek. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Emma.
How's life in the Rhodes world?
It's very well, thank you.
Excellent. Yeah. Delightfully to hear. He's come in with a really good notepad. It's sort of thumbed and slightly dog-eared, but in a very satisfying way. Always good to see pen and paper. On your notes, you've got copious notes in your notebook. What have you noted in terms of what we should all be reading in the papers today?
Well, there was a UN report that came out yesterday on the attack, on the Hamas-led attack on Israel on October 7th that did find reasonable grounds to support reports of sexual violence during the attack, which is quite a breakthrough because at the time, especially in the immediate aftermath, there were many women and women's groups and victims on that day who said that their voices weren't being heard. And so for the UN to come out and to say that they have discovered evidence of this is quite a breakthrough.
It is. And I think the one of the things that was highlighted in the UN report, which is that the mission team is of the view that the true prevalence of sexual violence during the 7th of October attacks and their aftermath may take months or years to emerge and may never be fully known. The fact that this is being highlighted and laid so clearly is something that, like you say, is a major breakthrough here, isn't it?
It definitely is. And the report is by Pramila Patten, the UN Secretary General's Special Representative on Sexual Violence on the conflict. And she said her trip to Israel and the West Bank, which took part earlier this year, was not intended to be an investigation, but to give voices to victims and survivors and to find ways to offer support, which including justice and accountability.
Okay. Let's move on to... So yesterday, France did something that no one else has done. They enshrined women's abortion rights in their constitution. I mean, it's 50 years? I think it's 1974 when France made abortion something perfectly legal in the country. But to place it in the constitution is a world first.
It definitely is. And President Macron made the move following the abolition of the rights in the United States with Roe v. Wade when that was struck down by the Supreme Court, which was used as a constitutional protection in the United States. And following that, the rules have gone back to the various states, and they were all very different. And so to have this, to avoid this issue in France, President Macron pushed to have this put into the Constitution, and it was voted through in a joint session yesterday, an overwhelming 780-72 votes in favor. The French public are behind this; about 80% wanted to see this go through. So there was a overwhelming support. And yeah, there was celebration, but there were celebrations that this was such it's a momentous occasion, and with My Body, My Choice being projected onto the Eiffel Tower, and there's going to be a special ceremony on International Women's Rights Day, which is Friday, to announce the law.
It's interesting insofar as, and as the article in Le Monde that you've drawn my attention to indicates, that none of France's major political parties represented in Parliament have questioned the right to abortion. Those who have a slightly more cynical approach say that Emmanuel Macron is just ever so slightly trying to appease to the left here, to try to make a political point where actually there is perhaps no need to make one.
It's true, because even the far right Rassemblement National with Marine Le Pen, she said that her party would not vote against it, although some of their members did, but her party was not against it. And but she said there was no need to make this a historic day. But I guess it would be very cynical to say this is just virtue signaling, but obviously that they wanted to make sure that there weren't any future problems, but also as a win for the left is certainly true.
And where does this place France in terms of, and this is a world first, so how does that sort of shape the way that the world might see France in the future? Indeed, it has been said that the French government wants this to be replicated across other nations.
Whether that happens, I guess we're in a very, a strange world where there's a lot of religious extremism and a lot of people that are against this in Christian communities and in other communities. So whether this is a form of a leadership move by Macron to kind of change the discussion and, further the Enlightenment values of Europe and the West.
Let's look at an article in the Financial Times now. The Church of England has been urged to target £1 billion in funding for a new investment fund to address its involvement in the transatlantic slave trade after an earlier pledge was deemed insufficient. This is an historic problem which is slowly being addressed, but there's a sense that the speed is not fast enough.
There's certainly a sense on one side that the speed is not fast enough, and there's a sense on the other side that the amounts of money involved are perhaps too much. Or how do you do this? Previously it was said that Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, had set aside $100 million for this impact investment fund, which would target groups that were historically affected by the transatlantic slave trade. Now, a new report by the Bishop Rosemary Mallet has said that this needs to be £1 billion, which a previous report had noted that the church had made approximately £1 billion in today's money through slave trade. So I don't think that's the direct trading of slaves, but other things that went on during that time they had profited from. So you look at the United States, California has come up with the figures of over $1 million for people. New York State is investigating now of looking at what they might need to or want to pay out to people in who have been affected communities. And there is some frothing on the right, especially in the Daily Mail this morning, saying this is a ridiculous amount. $1 billion is a ridiculous amount of money. But I mean, how do you address this? And it's a big question. And I wouldn't want to be an accountant having to look at it.
Indeed. And the money would go in, according to the Financial Times, in investments into disadvantaged black communities via a range of, and I'm quoting here, health, education and social entrepreneurship. It is also recommended that the church's financial arm starts dispersals this year. I mean, there's a sense that they want this all to happen incredibly quickly.
Yes. I think there needs to be some action on this. And in the US at the minute, there's only been one small county, just at a suburb of Chicago, who have been giving housing grants to disadvantaged families through a fund similar to this that are a lot smaller than some of the other figures given. But it's a start.
Okay. Finally, there is a significant amount of interest in Taylor Swift from certain parts of Midori House. Others are sort of slightly prefer to step back a little. But there's a really good story in The Guardian about the fact that Taylor Swift is related to one of America's most famous female poets.
Yes. Well, a genealogy site, who I'm not going to name because this is obviously a shameless PR move by them, it said that she is related to Emily Dickinson and that she is is a sixth cousin three times removed. And which is, I think, more than anything.
Okay.
Exactly. She's probably related to Queen Victoria as well. Who knows, as everybody is. But I think this is it is quite shameless by this company of anyone trying to associate themselves with Taylor Swift, as she is the world's most famous woman currently. And she is so wildly popular. And she's also, you know, very popular in Newsweek towers as well. So you're not alone here at Midori House.
The interesting thing is that Emily Dickinson was a recluse. She never, ever published anything, or she published anonymously while she was alive, and obviously became this enormously important figure in American literature. One wonders how long Taylor Swift's lyrics will last and whether a little bit of anonymity might be, I don't know, the order of the day in the future. Or do you think that we're never going to see that from Taylor Swift, are we?
No.
And well, do we place Taylor Swift's lyrics up there with Emily Dickinson's?
Well,
we do.
I'm sure some people do. Maybe Emily Dickinson might have been more comfortable if she could, you know, put out her prose on social media and could just stay behind a mask, or maybe be like a pop star like Sia, where you don't really know what she looks like. And it's not about that. It's about, you know, the words and the emotion and what she brings.
Paul Rhodes, thank you so much for making us wonder what Emily Dickinson's Instagram account might have looked like. The time here in London is 7:31. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. Let's have a look at what else we're keeping an eye on today. Israel's foreign minister has recalled the country's UN ambassador over claims that the United Nations try to keep quiet a report on sexual violence perpetrated by Hamas. The UN denies the allegations. A US Air National Guard has pleaded guilty to posting dozens of classified documents online. Jack Teixeira could face up to 17 years in jail after sharing documents on the gaming platform Discord. The material included maps, satellite images, and intelligence on US allies. And hardliners have won a majority of the seats in Iran's parliamentary elections, which saw a record low turnout of 41%. Most reformist candidates were barred from standing in the polls, the first since the 2022 protests. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, Flight Global is a website and organisation that's dedicated to reporting on flight safety and analysis of the aviation sector. So when Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 disappeared off the radar screens nearly 10 years ago, it was all hands on deck. In our continuing series ahead of the anniversary of MH370's disappearance, Monocle's Chris Chermak heard from Greg Waldron, Asia Managing Director at Flight Global and currently based in Singapore. Greg began by talking about the day everything went wrong.
Malaysian 370, contact Ho Chi Minh 120.9.
It was a Saturday morning. I woke up and I got a message from a colleague saying that a 777 had disappeared on the way to Beijing, and I was like stunned, right? I didn't even have a cup of coffee, and I'm trying to figure out what happened. And of course, then, you know, you're putting out reports to state that an aircraft has disappeared. But at the very initial stage, there was a really weird amount of, you know, information coming in, like, you know, just nobody could find the plane. And of course, the search was happening in, you know, sort of the South China Sea or the Gulf of Siam. I mean, this is a very early stage of the search as well. And there was a lot of satellite image coming through, like, apparently this is that. And it was just a lot of confusion around what had happened, especially in the first, you know, few days of that. And that Saturday was very confusing. It was bizarre.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it didn't get any less bizarre from there on out. How did you go about at the time with Flight Global as well, kind of trying to piece together what was happening, what was going on, the information that was coming out? It did, frankly, just get more bizarre, didn't it?
Yeah, well, frankly, with that type of story, you know, you're really just kind of trying to stick with facts. You know, an aircraft has disappeared. This is the aircraft. This is the registration number and so forth. you know, this is what is known right now. It was on this route. The Malaysian air traffic control lost it and it never signed up with Vietnamese air traffic control. So we kind of knew, like, we had these facts. But then, of course, you can fill it in with other stories where you talk about the safety record of the airline and the plane and so forth. But I think the key thing was that there was just so much weird disinformation coming out on social media, because social media was, you know, fully alive by this time. And there was all this stuff about, you know, wreckage has been found in the Gulf of Siam. Then there was a report that we kind of were looking at where Malaysia Airlines aircraft had been spotted somewhere in China. And of course, that turned out to be false. And there was all sorts of, you know, kind of leads like this early on. And, you know, of course, there was a, you know, the search and rescue effort got underway. I think Malaysia was sending helicopters and aircraft out over the Gulf of Siam, I guess it is Gulf of Thailand. You know, there's a lot of activity, very frenetic. Then there was a lot of other stuff, too, like there was no distress call from the airliner, which was mysterious. It was a very weird episode. Typically, when you have a major accident, there is, you know, something, right? You know, there's a distress call. There's something that happens, or else there's a big amount of wreckage, or somebody's seen something. This MH370 is really unique, frankly.
I did want to ask you one other aspect of this, which is Malaysian Airlines. I mean, what a tremendous blow this was for them, given also that we don't really know what happened, but not least also because of MH17 being shot down over Ukraine 4 months later. I wonder if you could tell us what happened to the airline at the time and how they managed to come out of this.
From my perspective, in a sense, they were kind of like diametrically opposite incidences. Whereas, you know, MH370 was among the greatest mysteries, probably is the greatest mysteries in aviation history, the disappearance of MH370. Whereas MH17 was a very clear-cut case that, you know, the aircraft had been shot down over a conflict zone. I mean, you couldn't have two situations that are more different than air safety. But going back to like Malaysia Airlines, I mean, it was devastating for Malaysia Airlines. I mean, they were already struggling, you know, financially at the time of MH370. And of course, this was like a devastating blow for the employees, I mean, dealing with all the speculation, all of the media attention. You had hundreds of, you know, reporters up there staying at the Sama Sama Hotel at KL Airport. I mean, it was just this massive amount of attention, you know, focusing on MH370. And then, of course, when MH17 happened, you know, the same people, you know, the disaster, the people that are tasked in that airline with, you know, responding to the disaster and, you know, dealing with the crisis like this were suddenly called back. So once things had kind of started to die down a little bit, suddenly they're all back. And then, you know, it's another tremendous tragedy. So I think it was, you know, an awful blow for Malaysia Airlines at the time.
And they were nationalized shortly after that. Was that inevitable? How do you feel that went? Is that a model, I guess, an inevitable kind of model for these situations? But it is something that they have managed to recover from.
Yeah, I mean, they did have the privatization, and that was probably on the cards for quite a while because they were struggling. But I think, you know, the twin disasters, you know, certainly kind of pushed that, you know, inevitability that they were taken over by the government. And, this, and in the subsequent years, you know, you've seen them go through a few iterations of a plan. But I think finally now, you know, they have a fairly clear-eyed plan on what they want to do, on what their strategy is. And it's somewhat less ambitious as it might have been, say, in the early 2010s. But I think it's something that they can manage and is quite manageable. So they've kind of had to take a long time to really, you know, draw back, to really recover. But I think they're kind of on the right track right now.
And just finally, Greg, I wonder if there were any other lasting impacts for the aviation industry as a whole, particularly just in terms of in Asia, whether people at the time were more worried about flying, whether we saw a dip in that sense in passenger traffic. How did airlines, not just Malaysian Airlines, but others as well, go about recovering from that moment?
I was on a Malaysia Airlines flight to KL and then Tokyo in, I think, October 2014, and it was packed. I mean, people were flying Malaysia Airlines. People went back to the carrier. But the issue was, you know, I think the ticket prices were quite low, right? So, you know, it's very hard to make money given their cost base. So I don't think it really dented the demand for air travel. And I think it kind of put a greater highlight on, you know, air safety. So, for example, like if you fly some airlines right now and the pilot needs to go to the washroom, you'll have a flight attendant that goes and sits in the cockpit with the pilot. So there's like these little safety tweaks that you kind of notice maybe at the front of the plane that you might not have seen before. But otherwise, I think, you know, the industry kind of has kind of moved on from MH370. It's still a tremendous mystery. We'll probably never know exactly what happened. But yeah, it's certainly something I'll never forget. But definitely one of the most intense periods in my career flight.
Malaysian 370, contact Ho Chi Minh 120.9. Right.
That was Greg Waldron talking to Monocle's Chris Chermak. You can hear more in a special edition of the Monocle Weekly this Friday on the anniversary of MH370's disappearance. You're listening to Monocle Radio. It's 15:39 in Beijing, 8:39 a.m. in Zurich. Now, for the first time in 3 decades, there will be no press conference after the end of China's annual parliamentary sessions. Not just this year, this apparently is the new norm. Well, David Schlesinger is an independent advisor and commentator on media journalism and on China. And he's delighted to say he joins me once again in the studio. Good morning, David. You've come into the studio long enough. I should know how to introduce you, but it's good to have you, however clumsily my efforts are.
Nice to be here.
So just explain to us a little bit about the annual parliamentary sessions. They are the time when China sets its budget and sets its path, isn't it?
Sort of. So China has a system where the Communist Party is really in charge of everything. And the parliament, the National People's Congress, is the executive. It follows the orders. It actually implements the plans that were set in the midst of the Communist Party regime. So it's more a rubber stamp to policies that have already been set, but it's the first time we hear about things like the economic growth. But you should know that this is really the world's largest parliament. We've got 2,977 delegates sitting in the Great Hall of the People. It's huge. It's enormous. And at the same time, there's a meeting of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, which is another 2,000 delegates. So you've got close to 5,000 parliamentarians wandering around Beijing and sitting in vast meeting halls. For a journalist, it's backbreaking and sometimes extremely tedious.
And quieter now because there is no great press conference after that. I mean, why is that? I mean, what normally happens in these press conferences?
Well, it's not a press conference as you as a Western journalist might think. It's a high, the premier's press conference was always a highly scripted, very choreographed presentation. But I have to say, we China watchers are a very sad bunch of nerds because we hung on this choreographed, scripted presentation as if it were gold dust because we looked for every nuance. We looked for every change of expression. Was there a different way of phrasing things? How relaxed did the premier look? We are a sad bunch. And so it won't happen this year. They say there will be smaller press conferences of ministers here and there. I think really you have to look at two important themes of the Xi Jinping era, Xi Jinping being the president of China and the head of the Communist Party. Number one is a trend away from openness and towards more opacity. He doesn't like us to know what's going on. Number one. But number two is he doesn't like to have anyone upstaging him. And one of the things that we as China watchers always did when we watched the premier at a press conference, we tried to see, is there a difference between what the premier said and what the president said? Is there any light between the two? And Xi Jinping doesn't want any of that.
Well, I mean, let's examine this a little bit more in detail. I mean, you mentioned the fact that it's highly choreographed, but then you said you see expressions, you see a human face to this. And this is not just an opportunity for journalists to see how China's number two, how the premier is seeing how China's economy and political future is being laid out. But it is the only chance that the Chinese get to see the way that China operates in a more human light. And this is arguably the one channel being eliminated which allows people to see how the Chinese go about their policy making, and they get a direct contact with the premier here.
I think it's clear that in the Xi Jinping era, the role of the premier is being diminished. In the past, premiers went rushing around the country whenever there was any kind of natural disaster, Li Qiang did not do that most recently. So I think Xi Jinping wants to be the man. He wants to be the figure that people look up to. He wants his ideology to be the number one ideology. He doesn't want anyone to think that there's any other possible rival. What that means when he then leaves the stage is a very serious and open question. But for the moment, he wants to be unchallenged.
Just let's talk a little bit about what was in the parliamentary sessions. The GDP target, watched closely, at around 5%, they're now saying that. I mean, what kind of language has been used around that target? And I mean, how do we interpret the announcement?
So 5% is something that most Western leaders would kill for. I think in Britain, they're thinking that we might get 5% if you add the next 4 years together. But 5% in 1 year is by world standards, not bad. But by Chinese standards, it's very, very slow. I mean, it is a sign that the economy is slowing, that there are serious headwinds. China has a couple of near-term problems, and it has a very serious long-term problems. The near-term problems is there's a lot of debt, there's a lot of problems in the real estate sector, and of course, you've got the United States and its allies very much lined up against China, which was not the case 10 years ago, 20 years ago. The long-term problem is that China's population is aging, and it's got deflation, an aging population. It's not a really robust picture. So 5% would be pretty good if they pull it off.
David, thank you so much for joining me in the studio. That was David Schlesinger. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
/7:46 here in London. Let's talk business now with Victoria Scholar, Head of Investment at Interactive Investor. A very good morning to you, Victoria.
Morning.
Let us begin with this fine handed out to Apple by the EU over its music streaming competition. Explain what's happened, would you please?
Yes, that's right. So the tech giant Apple has been fined €1.84 billion by the European Commission, which is the third biggest fine it's ever imposed. And it follows an investigation into the restrictions that Apple forces on rival music services like Spotify within its app. So the decision comes in light of a complaint from Spotify, which argues that Apple's restrictions have actually benefited Apple at the expense of some of the rivals. And this is actually the first time that Apple has faced a punishment for breaching EU law. And Margrethe Vestager, who's the competition chief, said that the tech giant broke antitrust rules by restricting developers from informing consumers about alternative, cheaper music services available outside of the Apple ecosystem. And as a result, we saw that shares reacted pretty badly. Apple fell around 2.5%. And that extends a tough period for Apple, which has now shed nearly 6% in just over 2 months since the start of 2024.
How does it intend to proceed with this? Because one would imagine that it will try to appeal.
I assume that that will probably be the next step because, of course, this is a hefty fine that is going to cost Apple dearly. Like I said, it is the biggest fine ever imposed by the EU. We know that it has fined other tech giants, but for Apple, this is a first. And this is an issue that has been talked about a lot around the fact that users get very much engulfed in Apple's ecosystem. And that means that it can promote its own products and services over others, whereas it needs to be that there's fair competition for consumers so that they have a choice between, say, Apple's music services and other music services, but that extends to a whole suite of different products.
There is a wider question here, isn't there, about the European Union and big tech. And if you just look at the front page of the FT today, its big read is, will big tech agree to play by Europe's rules? This week is a deadline for large online platforms to comply with new EU regulations on competition. Too little, too late, say some. Is there the sense that actually the European Union can do what it can, but actually these companies are far too big?
Well, I think that's definitely an important point, because these are huge revenue generators, huge profit makers, and in turn, huge tax generators as well within European countries. And of course, they're mainly domiciled in the US. And that's the reason why US stock markets have performed so much better than those in the UK or other European countries or elsewhere over the last few years. And so there is a sort of push-pull situation going on, where the EU certainly doesn't want to upset these companies to the extent that they actually end up leaving.
Let's move to Bitcoin. The price of Bitcoin has gone past $65,000.
Yes, that's right. It's been on a tear. It actually pushed above $67,000 briefly this week, now trading around $66,600 against the US dollar. So it's broken above these key milestones for the first time since November of 2021. Some are suggesting that it could hit an all-time high this week of 69,000. Now, to explain just how sizable this rally has been, Bitcoin has gained 56% over the last month alone, and it's up about 200% over the last year. And all of this has been driven by the fact that US-listed Bitcoin exchange-traded funds began trading in January, and these funds have enjoyed major inflows of over $7 billion, which allows investors to invest in cryptos more easily and provides greater legitimacy and liquidity to the asset class that, of course, can draw quite a lot of skepticism. But while I can see the appeal, it is important to remember that it is an extremely volatile asset class. And while there can be days or months or even years of major gains, there can also be heavy losses as well. So it's not for the faint-hearted.
It's strange, isn't it, that in the years that Bitcoin has been around, we are still asking questions about its validity and just how reliable an investment it is.
Yeah, and I think that the sort of main crux of this is that we're waiting to see whether it does end up having widespread adoption as a rival to fiat currencies like the pound or the US dollar. At the moment, not many people pay for their transactions using cryptos, other than in some niche areas online. So I think that's going to be the next real major hurdle where we start actually seeing Bitcoin as a legitimate form of payment in shops or in traditional retail spaces.
Finally, a quick look at the Nikkei. That has absolutely jumped in the last few days, hasn't it?
Yes, that's right. This is the main stock index in Japan. It's broken above 40,000, hitting a fresh record high. It's now topped the highs seen in the bubble in the 1980s. And it's actually the world's top performing stock index so far this year, up about 20% since the start of 2024. And behind this really is the fact that while in the UK or the US or Europe, central banks have been raising interest rates to curtail inflation, Japan has gone the other way. It's stuck to its ultra loose monetary policy, which of course is very accommodative to markets when interest rates are below zero, where they've been for almost 10 years.
Victoria Scholar, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. Finally, last week, the New York Times headlined the fact that out of the 48 outfits shown at the Saint Laurent show last week in Paris, only 12 didn't have what was described as breasts front and centre. In fact, the overriding reaction of a lot of what was shown at Paris Fashion Week was rather see-through. Well, I'm joined now by Dana Thomas, Paris-based author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. A very good morning to you, Dana.
Morning.
We will move to the rest of the you know the autumn and winter collections right across Europe in a moment. But we do have to deal with this thing that started off at Saint Laurent, didn't it? That no one seemed to have any underwear on, and it started as a little bit of a joke. But there's been some quite serious commentary about it, not least in the New York Times, saying this is a very strange thing that seems to have happened.
Well, I mean, fashion has gone through its moments like this. Yves Saint Laurent was the first one to reveal breasts through sheer chiffon back in the 1960s. So it's not a new idea. And of course, in the 90s, John Galliano was doing this all the time, as was Alexander McQueen. And but back then, you know, we were in a less conservative time. And women actually would go out braless with, you know, and you could see through their shirts and it was kind of okay. But it's not anymore. And you know, we can't even see a bit of nipple and rippling, you know, like it's kind of gotten very, the whole idea has gotten very vulgar and shocking. And so this idea that fashion is trying to bring the boob back to fashion and or even, as they say, release the nipple is kind of it's kind of funny because it's getting rejected. It's getting a hard pass really, really quickly by the customer and by critics. One of the things that's, you know, most interesting is because it isn't going to be embraced by the customer like it was 25 years ago, most of those clothes that we're seeing on the runway like that will not be produced as they are.
It's interesting, isn't it, that there was a suggestion that the, you know, being so bold and so daring with showing bodies was actually a sort of kickback to the fact that fashion doesn't have any good ideas anymore. I mean, are we really at that stage? Because I thought there were plenty of lovely things to see right across all the collections.
Right. Well, the problem is, as I said, you know, Saint Laurent was the originator of this, and I saw a lot of Saint Laurent 1960s and 70s references throughout Fashion Week while I was here. And fashion doesn't have a lot of new ideas. It's very rare to find new ideas. Instead, as I saw one time on a Sunday at the library, you know, I saw a fashion assistant just paging through all the 1980s Vogues and Harper's Bazaars and taking pictures to take. And she did this for several Sundays in a row to take into the office on Monday so they could figure out what to redesign as something new. That they can't stop referencing the recent past, and because they've run out of their own organic ideas.
So tell us what we did see that possibly inspired us a little more than what you've just been talking about.
Well, I did see a lot of beauty, but it's funny because I felt, as I wrote in my Substack newsletter, that fashion's still completely stuck in this sort of post-COVID, we must cover up and comfort ourselves era, period. And, it, you know, we've been out of the COVID pandemic a couple years now, but they're still sending out these huge, huge suits with gigantic shoulders. So, you know, like we're protecting or enveloping ourselves, and cashmere, long cashmere dresses and huge cashmere, like ginormous cashmere sweaters, just to like, so you're like, look like you're wearing a blanket. Otherwise, you go the complete opposite direction. And you're in your lingerie. You're in like a lace cat suit that's completely sheer, and you're walking down the street in your underwear. So it's a very weird dichotomy that there really isn't much of an in-between. You're either completely shrouded or you're next to naked.
And we're just wondering which option we're all going to go for next season.
I think we're going to go with the shrouded. I think we're going to see a lot of full jackets, full pants, soft fabrics that are very... very Annie Hall.
Tell us a little bit about what else you've found absolutely beautiful this, you know, not just Annie Hall, but we've got about 30 seconds. Where should we be looking?
Well, what
for inspiration?
I found the most exciting was at Stella McCartney, where she nicely had both her father, Paul McCartney, and Ringo Starr. So Beatlemania there. She has taken some of the biomaterials I've seen at conferences and actually scaled them up to real outfits as opposed to a handbag here and there. There was a faux leather trench that looked like a crocodile trench. Beautiful. There was several outfits covered in biosequins, including these really cool faded jeans with a biosequin faded front. So biosequins meaning that they're not made of plastic. They will eventually biodegrade into the earth. And she's supporting these startups and getting these alternative materials out there that are greener and safer for the planet and trying to get us off petroleum-based materials or animal skins and bravo for her because it was gorgeous.
Dana Thomas, thank you as ever for joining us on The Globalist. That's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to the producers, Vincent McAvinney, Laura Kramer and Christy O'Grady. Our researcher is Naomi Ekwa and our studio manager was Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The briefing's live at midday here in London and The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.